Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, watch out for an accident 101 northbound in the East Valley at Southern. Sunny skies in the Valley forecast for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 84 degrees. Clear tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 78 degrees.
In surprising news this morning, Arizona's 5th District Congressman Matt Salmon announced he wouldn't run for re-election. It's the second time in Salmon's career he has left the House on his own. As recently as last fall, he was being mentioned as a possible primary challenger to Senator John McCain. Salmon says the decision comes down to the desire to spend more time with his family.
It's not about politics at all. It's about my family and being with them. There's no political calculus at all. It's just a father and husband that wants to be where his heart is.
Salmon has endorsed State Senate President Andy Biggs to be his successor, but that is not expected to stop a lot of ambitious people from also jumping in the race. To provide some clues as to what's next, I'm joined by former lawmaker Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting. Stan, were you as stunned as others were about Salmon's decision?
Yes, I was surprised. And it's remarkable for a number of reasons. One, I think it was a well-kept secret in the political world. And two, Matt Salmon might be the only person in the history of the United States Congress to voluntarily leave his congressional seat, not once, but twice.
Right. Let's think about what many people were trying to do on the real conservative side, trying to get him to challenge Senator McCain. Do you think there was any indication that he just wanted to get out of this realm? Because my thinking as a non-strategist was, well, if you're going to leave the House, why not run for Senate anyway?
It may be exactly what Matt Salmon says it is, that he just wants to do something different and spend a little more time as a normal person. I take him at his word, but I can also believe that if someone desired to run for the United States Senate in the future, that this actually could be a way to tee that up. The mood of the electorate is so clearly anti-incumbent and anti-Washington that I think Salmon actually scores big political points by walking out of the House instead of being carried out.
So he is supporting State Senate President Andy Biggs to replace him, to succeed him. First of all, what do you think about that? And secondly, will that stop the gates from opening to many other candidates?
It's a very interesting political phenomenon that the sitting incumbent is chosen his successor and is going all in on it. Evidently, Andy Biggs is the only guy in the political world that knew this was happening, and he had a leg up on all his rivals, of which I think there will be many. It's such a sweet spot politically. It is geographically a very small district. It is also a homogeneous district. It's an easy district to be a conservative, white Republican male in. And I bet there's going to be a number of people run for that seat, no matter who Matt Salmon supports.
Now, give us a few names, because you mentioned conservative, because a couple names that popped to mind for me who are very different people are Scott Smith and Russell Pierce.
Yeah, that district has some colorful characters in it. Yes, Russell Pierce could run. Yes, Scott Smith should be on the list. You've got to put Kirk Adams on that list. He just lost that seat in a very close race to Matt Salmon only 3 years ago. And you also must add Justin Olson, who's a state representative from Mesa area, who's the speaker in waiting, I might add, in the Arizona State House. I also think names on the list belong like Denny Barney or Steve Chukri. Those two gentlemen are Maricopa supervisors from the East Valley. It's not out of the question to put someone like Tom Farese on that list, former legislator, sitting corporation commissioner, and from Chandler. There's a lot of and that's just people that are presently elected or in the political game. I mean, that doesn't count the kind of people that could come out of the woodwork, that could that have some prominence, could raise their own money, because it always is going to end up being who has the resources to talk to voters. It's not about money. It's about an ability to reach a lot of voters. That usually means money, but it doesn't always mean money.
Former state lawmaker Stan Barnes, he is the man behind Copper State Consulting. Stan, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Steve, very much.
The largest group of voters in Arizona are independents, and in the past 3 years, new voter registrations of unaffiliated voters have outpaced the two major parties combined. But that changed this last voter registration period that ended Tuesday. The number of independents in Arizona dropped slightly. That's because unaffiliated voters can't participate in Arizona's upcoming presidential primary. Meanwhile, as KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports, independents in the state are waging a tough fight for more rights at the polls.
It may sound kind of like an oxymoron, but Arizona's unaffiliated, independent voters are banding together.
You are joining thousands of independent voters all over Arizona for this evening's town hall.
Patrick McWhorter of the group Open Primaries led this recent phone conference. Organizers say more than 13,000 people dialed into the call.
Independent voters. Now, 37% of all Arizona registered voters are treated like second-class citizens.
I should say here that independents are now actually 36% after the latest registration deadline. McWhorter's group is trying to get a pair of ballot initiatives on the November ballot. One would give independents more choice by changing state primaries so every candidate would appear on a single ballot. The top two candidates would advance regardless of party.
How are you? You registered voter? Can I talk to you about open primaries?
Outside the downtown Phoenix Public Library, David Hanley is trying to get signatures for the ballot initiatives. Hanley says he doesn't like the current primary system for state races. Independents can vote, but they have to choose one party's ballot and can't split their ticket.
I wanted to have a better choice of who to vote for.
Across town in Tempe, retired accountant Deb Gain Braley has also recently become an activist for unaffiliated voter rights. She's new to the independent camp, having just switched her registration from Republican last year.
I felt like the party I was in wasn't speaking to me anymore.
Then Gain Braley discovered there were downsides to being unaffiliated in Arizona, like she wouldn't be able to participate in the upcoming March 22nd presidential primary unless she was willing to re-register with a party, and she didn't want to do that.
I think that no one should have to choose a party to be able to vote in America.
Now she volunteers for a campaign called Independent Voters for Arizona that's trying to open the presidential primary election. The director is Timothy Castro. He argues it's not fair to exclude over a million independent voters from a presidential primary paid for with their taxpayer dollars.
If we're paying for something that we're not allowed to vote in, then let us vote in it or don't make me pay for it.
That logic has struck a chord with Secretary of State Michelle Reagan. Here she is earlier this month speaking to a state House committee about the presidential primary, pointing out that independents are more than a third of the state's voters.
This is the one election that they cannot participate in. And yet, as taxpayers, everybody pays for these elections.
But Reagan isn't backing a change to let independents participate. Instead, she supports a bill that would defund the presidential primary so taxpayers would be off the hook. She says if the presidential primary is a party function,
then the political parties and not the taxpayers should consider paying for this.
The state Republican chair hasn't taken a position on the bill. The Democratic Party opposes it, saying participation will drop if the parties have to run caucuses. An alternate proposal in the House to instead open up the presidential primary to independents was defeated, and the bill to defund the presidential primary has passed in the House. Meanwhile, independent voters promise they'll keep pushing for a way into the presidential primary eventually. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
State lawmakers are debating twin bills in the House and Senate that would phase out desegregation funding to the 19 school districts that get it. The money is used for providing equal opportunity education for low-income and minority students. Districts are allowed to increase property taxes to raise the money. State Senator Debbie Lesko is the sponsor of her chamber's version of the measure.
desegregation funding, I think, is inherently unfair. There's extra money that goes to 19 school districts in the state, and only 19 school districts in the state. And what it is it's in two of the cases, in two of the school districts, it was a court order that dates back to the 80s about segregation, racial segregation. And so the legislature gave authority to these districts to tax their local taxpayers more money to solve that problem. Well, obviously, decades have passed. The problem has gone away. This is unfair to the taxpayers in those school districts, and it's unfair to the neighboring school districts because these districts get extra money per student for something that no longer exists.
Are you concerned when you hear from the districts about some of the programs or, in some cases, entire schools that might have to be shut down because they would potentially lose this money?
There's other mechanisms in place where school districts can go out to their voters for bonds or overrides, and that system is set up, it's legal. What is unfair is this desegregation where some school districts, only 19 of them in the entire state, can get this extra money. That's just unfair to the school districts that aren't allowed to get it. So if the school district needs to go out and get extra money to replace this, they have a mechanism to do so now. They go out to the voters and they ask for it.
If this bill passes and becomes law, and either yours or the House version, do you expect to have some kind of challenge to this?
There's no way that I can prevent anybody from filing lawsuit. I would think it would be unwise. I think that if they did sue, they would have a hard time defending their cause. When they, in many cases, they don't even know the reason. They don't even have the original letter or complaint anymore. Some of these date back to the 70s. And so they're just taxing people money. They're getting the extra money. They may be using it for good cause, but it's not the cause that the tax was intended for. It was supposed to be a temporary tax to fix a racial inequity problem that now it no longer exists, yet they're still taxing these people. That's unfair.
State Senator Debbie Lesko is the sponsor of Senate Bill 1125, which would phase out school desegregation money for most of the districts that get it. One of them is the Phoenix Union High School District. It had been under a court order, but in 2005 moved to unitary status, basically meaning a judge found the district was doing okay with its equal opportunity efforts, but if it got less money, the court may have to revisit the issue. Chad Geston is the superintendent of the Phoenix Union High School District.
Phoenix Union receives about $55 million per year in desegregation funding.
And what does that money pay for?
The money pays for programs and in many cases, some schools to guarantee equity and excellence for all kids across our system.
Can you give me some examples of some things that you would have to lose or would have to cut if this money went away, if this bill became law?
Absolutely. A few examples of programs or schools. One would be the North High Inter Baccalaureate program. You know, it's one of the most successful IB programs in the state of Arizona. It's almost primarily funded by IB. We also have some great magnet programs around our district. You've heard a lot about the Carl Hayden Robotics program. Even had a documentary, even a motion picture filmed about the success of that program. That, too, is a desegregation-funded program.
Is there an argument to be made that some of these programs are wonderful programs for a district to have, but maybe desegregation money, this particular pool of potential money, is not the way to fund them?
Well, at the end of the day, in order for us to provide the right academic, you know, quality and excellence for all of our kids, the funds are needed to make that happen. Whether that funding comes through desegregation funding or other funding, for us to provide quality programs for such a large, diverse group of students, almost 85% of whom live at or below the federal poverty line, and almost 90% of whom are ethnic minorities, funding is absolutely necessary.
Would trying to pass an override be an option in your district?
Phoenix Union actually has been very successful passing overrides for decades. We have run overrides as well as bonds to maintain facilities, and since 1980 have been extremely successful with bonds and overrides.
How much money would your district get if Proposition 123 passes relative to what you might lose if desegregation funding goes away?
Proposition 123 would bring into Phoenix Union for this next school year approximately $6 million. And we would, if HB 1125 or HB 2401, SB 1125 passes, we would lose $55 million, so a net loss of almost $50 million.
If this bill gets signed into law, I mean, do you have any recourse? Would you consider filing a lawsuit, or is there some other challenge that you could do to this?
Well, the reality is, if these funds are taken away at the legislature, there will be conversations that will happen at the court level. There's the court order in 2005. Actually reads something like this. It says that the courts will retain control or jurisdiction of this case if the Arizona legislature at any time, and it uses these words, has any time has the effect of decreasing, terminating, or otherwise interfering with existing and ongoing DSEG programs. And so it would be guaranteed to head straight back to the courts if the legislature takes any action.
Chad Gaston is the superintendent of the Phoenix Union High School District, which is one of 19 in the state that currently gets desegregation money.
Jeannie Powers is an associate professor in the Fulton Teachers College at ASU. She's looked into desegregation. Jeannie, what are the key components of current state policy?
We've got these districts that are under these orders, either these voluntary agreements, because there's 17 that have these voluntary agreements, and then there's the two that resulted from court orders. And so the state policy that is an issue in this legislation stems from a bill passed by the state legislature in 1983. And this allowed districts that were under these court orders that had entered into these voluntary agreements with the Office of Civil Rights to levy higher local property taxes to pay for desegregation programs. So it's less about the details of the programs, but more that the districts were allowed to levy these additional funds to address the problems identified by the Office of Civil Rights.
Is there any indication that people in districts are clamoring to say, you know, we've solved this, we don't need this funding anymore?
I guess this is the way to think about it. I mean, because all of the districts have different situations. So there are currently 19 districts that are able to levy for additional property taxes without voter approval. And they raise in total across all of these districts about $211 million. Now, about 89% of that is funded from local property taxes. Now, if we're wondering, like, is this something that's supported, I think an important other contextual issue to know is that at least 10 of the 19 school districts that levied for desegregation funds also passed school bonds or overrides in 2014 and 2015, and most of these were budget overrides for operating funds. So these were voter-approved increases in their districts' operating budgets. And in a number of these districts, you know, they passed by substantial margins. So they weren't like kind of these razor thin, you know, just passing by a hair type ballot initiatives.
Jeannie, what are districts using the money for? And will they have to potentially restructure in some ways without those funds?
All of districts experienced severe state funding cuts during the recession. Mm-hmm. And so this can put these districts in a difficult position of having to cut programs if the funds can't be found elsewhere. One of the things that you can do is you can look across the descriptions of what the districts are doing with the dollars. And it's clear that the funds support a fair number of teachers and other support staff that serve disadvantaged students. And so these funds go for things like smaller class sizes, support staff for language minority students. And so the loss in funding will have a substantial impact on the students served by these programs and also these staff members. The other thing that some districts have also raised is that they may, in some cases, have to close schools. And this also has effects on neighborhoods.
Jeannie Powers, associate professor in the Fulton Teachers College at ASU. House and Senate versions of the legislation are both ready for debate by all members. The Syrian refugee crisis continues. Over the past 5 years, millions have been displaced, and 40% of those people are children. And today, groups of migrants found themselves stranded in Greece after refugee restrictions were put in place by Austria and Balkan nations. Michael Ignatieff is a former political leader in Canada and currently a professor of practice at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He'll be speaking tonight at ASU, and he joins me now. Michael, do you believe the U.S. is coming up short in assisting refugees from Syria?
In the years since the Syrian revolt started in 2011, that is 4 or 5 years, the United States has taken less than 3,000 Syrian refugees. And that's a bit of a contrast with, I think, America's image of itself as being a country that's been very receptive.
I'm curious about the perception of people when it comes to sort of this post 9/11 world that we talk about a lot here in America, this idea that now if there is someone who could possibly have a false passport of some sort and get into the U.S., that seems to be more of a concern for a lot of people than the plight of the refugees who are in fact suffering. I wonder if there's, do you see that as not a valid obstacle, but as a significant obstacle and a real obstacle?
Oh, look, you know, the first duty of any government is to keep people safe, and the first concern of citizens is to make sure they're safe, and they don't want their generosity abused with a sleeper cell or somebody coming in. I think those are really legitimate concerns, and nobody who's in favor of refugees should kind of wave them aside as if they don't matter. But there's a difference between zero risk and risk management. We don't want to have a policy towards strangers in the United States that says no risk is the only risk. We're, you know, that's not going to work. I mean, this country, let's remember, takes in a million people a year. You know, half a million get green cards, another half a million from outside get another. We take in 65,000 refugees. We have millions of visitors, you know, coming to Arizona to see the beauty of Arizona every year from countries all over the world. This country would shut down if we weren't engaged in risk management rather than zero risk. Every time we let someone in from a foreign country, there's some element of risk, but we manage it because it ends up being so good for the United States.
Is this only a humanitarian challenge, or do you think there's more to it?
Let me put it this way, a strategic crisis. If you know, America understands that one of its oldest, longest allies is Europe. Europe has, you know, it's a free market society, capitalist society, similar values to ours. And for, you know, 70, 80 years, United States and Europe have stood together. If Europe comes apart under the refugee strain, you know, and it may well just break down, that's not good for the long-term security of the United States.
Your recent op-ed in the Washington Post has the line, this is what U.S. leadership in the 21st century should look like, bringing together force and diplomacy, moral commitment and strategic boldness around an urgent humanitarian objective that would command the support of the world. In that same op-ed, though, you use the phrase moral bankruptcy. Is that because the U.S. has abdicated too much of what's happened, the fact that we were not as active in Syria on many levels? Has that led us to this point? Was the U.S. strong enough to have put a wedge in this if it had acted a few years ago?
I think there's no question that had we said that once Mr. Assad, the ruler of Syria, used chemical weapons on his people, that the United States would respond with military action. And I think we are paying consequences for that mistake. And I also understand something else. The American public, for excellent reasons, is very, very skeptical about the use of military force anywhere, but especially in the Middle East. You can also push this too far. I think had we used limited, discriminate use of force to punish Assad and tell him he can't use chemical weapons on his people, that I think would have set in train the process by which we would have by now had a negotiated settlement. And the fact that we didn't act then means a lot of people in Syria are going to die that don't need to.
Michael Ignatieff is a professor of practice at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's speaking tonight at ASU in Tempe. His presentation is called What Citizens Owe Strangers, Human Rights, Migrants, and Refugees.
Soccer is a sport loved around the globe. People gather to cheer their home country in the World Cup and play in the fields in their hometowns.
For a group of refugees in Phoenix, soccer is a way to adjust to their new home and create a community on and off the field. We'll kick it over to the show's Annika Klein for more.
Down.
Kick it hard, kick it hard.
Hey, go quicker.
The players on Team Milan are trying to nail a complicated shot at practice. The idea is that a few players jump over the ball, and the player behind them scores, confusing the other team.
Ooh, ooh.
The under-15 team is part of North Phoenix Christian Soccer Club, but almost none of these players are originally from Phoenix.
My parents were from Central Africa, but I was born in Chad, so I grew up in Chad.
Desire Jacola and all but one of his teammates are refugees. They have similar stories. Some, like Jacola, were born in refugee camps outside their parents' homeland. Then their families ended up here. In a brand new place, there was at least one thing that felt familiar.
I like playing soccer because back in my country, we don't know nothing about football or basketball. So everyone like just plays soccer and stuff. So I was born playing soccer.
Jigola says it was an adjustment playing on grass instead of sand, but the heart of the sport is the same. The club has 12 teams, about 180 players total. It estimates about 95% of the players are refugees. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case, but a few refugees joined and others learned about the club through a friend or sibling, and the numbers grew. Anthony, too, follows in the footsteps of two older brothers who played with the club.
This is like family because, you know, we're all from different places. We're all refugees, so we all play and, you know, have fun together.
A lot of fun, but you can tell they take the sport seriously. Tu says soccer is life for him. After a hard time at school or at home, it's what he turns to.
Soccer's like the only thing that keeps me going right now. All I think about is soccer. When you play soccer, it's like happiness.
After practice, the team goes to McDonald's. Coach Miguel Vasquez is buying. His wife, Alondra Ruiz, says they often feed the team and do extra things off the field.
We drive them to practice and pick them up at home and drive them back. We drive them to all the games, and that's really beneficial to them because otherwise, I don't know that they could get to games or get to practices.
Many of the players' parents don't have cars, so they can't get the kids to practice. Sometimes they even have trouble finding transportation to work. So Ruiz stepped up to help with that too.
Yeah, there you go. Oh yeah, you could sit in the middle.
She drives a group of six refugees to work and leaves at 10:30 at night to pick them up. They're janitors in a school district in North Phoenix and get off too late to take a bus home.
Sometimes it's hard to, like right now I wish I could just go to bed, you know? But especially once they get in the car, it just, everything changes, you know? It's really worth what I'm doing. Every day you give me gum. Today, no gum.
The drive is about an hour and a half total.
Bye.
And tomorrow, Ruiz will do it all again. Take the workers to work, the kids to practice, the kids home, and take the workers home. It's a lot of driving, but she says it's the right thing to do.
We live in a society where people are really selfish, and they just want to take care of their little circle, their little families, and that's it. And they don't realize that there's people out there that need each other.
Ruiz's son doesn't even play in the club anymore, but she continues to be a resident soccer mom, and she's proud of it. She and the players and their parents, they formed a new family. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Take him up, shooter!
My name is Dixie Diane Miller. I've been shooting cowboy action shooting for 22 years now.
Yeehaw, 2772, and the counters say clean.
We have 12 stages. We have saloons, we have hotels and banks and anything you might think of in an old Western movie. My scenario is the mine shaft.
With your shotgun, 5 targets, knock them down.
1-2 on the first target, 3-4 on the second target. And it just has its own little rhythm when you get started. Everyone gets into character. Everyone has an alias, like mine is Dixie Belle, and we're all cowboys at heart.
That's Dixie Miller shooting at the Winter Range National Championship of Cowboy Action Shooting in North Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we're off target, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
It's tough to look anywhere in the valley and not see palm trees. Phoenix, though, is looking to do something different with all the palm fronds that come down in the city, and there are lots of them. The city has issued a request for proposals for a company to come in and do something with the fronds other than have them go to the landfill, which is where they go now. Gretchen Wolf is a project manager with Phoenix. She describes her job as creating economic activity based on what we put in our trash cans and recycling bins.
The city issued a call for innovators last year where we were asking people, if you're doing something new and different with what our residents put in the trash or recycle bins, we want to hear from you. And from that process, we received more than 100 responses from 75 organizations around the world with great ideas. Based on their responses, now we're issuing a series of RFPs so that we can offer up our trash and our recycling materials for business ideas that people, the marketplace, are telling us they can do. When we issued the Transforming Trash into Resources RFP, where we offered up some of the problem children of solid waste, think carpeting, mattresses, things that are just like big and bulky or expensive for the city to process. And we asked, is there anybody out there who can take these items and instead of us putting them in a landfill, take these back into the economy? And we did receive proposals for mattresses, carpeting, food waste, but we didn't get anything for palm fronds. And in an interview, our city manager was talking about palm fronds being a problem child, and the reporter finished the story saying, so if you have any great ideas about palm fronds, let us know. And people did.
What were some of those ideas?
So I don't want to give away too many ideas because this is an active RFP, and we want people to be creative and come up with great ideas to come and be located in Phoenix to repurpose these palm fronds. And we estimate we get about 34,000 tons of palm fronds every year. And that's just Phoenix.
When you talk about repurposing them, are you talking about turning them into something else or just some way to get them out of the landfill?
Well, we're looking for somebody to turn them into something else. So people have told us that they can make energy out of palm fronds. They can make consumer goods out of palm fronds. And so we've offered up in this RFP the opportunity for a company to come and be at the City of Phoenix Resource Innovation Campus, have a site right there near our transfer station, and then take these palm fronds, process them, and come up with another product that will come back into the economy instead of these palm fronds going to our landfill where they're just going to sit there and eventually decompose.
What do other cities do with their palm fronds? I mean, Phoenix is clearly not the only city in the world that has them.
Most palm fronds are put into the landfill. They don't compost well, so even cities that have a composting facility and cities that are planning on a composting facility like Phoenix are looking for another option. And when this idea was exposed to the marketplace through a phone radio interview, we heard from people in the business place that there are ways to repurpose these palm fronds and put them back into the economy, which means more jobs and hopefully more jobs here in Phoenix.
Is there something different about palm fronds that makes them different to work with than other types of materials, other maybe plant materials that you're also trying to keep out of landfills?
Well, the difference for palm fronds is they're stringy, so that when the machines that would normally process green organics are chewing them up and grinding them up, the strings from the palm fronds can wrap around that equipment and damage that equipment. So then that equipment is down or there's additional cost to repair it. So if you have another solution for palm fronds, it's better all the way around.
What criteria will the city be using in terms of picking one of those ideas to go with?
So the evaluation criteria our evaluation panel will use, we'll be looking at the qualifications and experience of the company. We want to see their business plan. Remember, this is a company that's not only going to be taking our palm fronds, but we want them to be located right here in Phoenix, creating economic activity here, employing our residents. So we want to know this is a viable business plan. We also want to understand the financial return and the benefits to the city. And finally, we're going to be looking at the proposed technology or manufacturing process.
Gretchen Wolf is a project manager with the City of Phoenix. We were talking about the city's request for proposals for a company to divert palm fronds from the landfill. The RFP is open until March 30th. The City Council could vote on a company or companies in September.
It's lights out for the solar industry in Nevada. That state is hemorrhaging jobs after a decision to raise rates for customers with rooftop solar panels. The move has jarred the solar industry, especially in other Southwest states like Arizona. And as KJZZ's Will Stone reports, businesses hope the Nevada controversy doesn't travel south.
When Nevada upturned how solar customers get charged, it cast a shadow far beyond state lines. Just ask Brandon Cheshire, whose company Sun Harvest is putting up panels at a home in Scottsdale.
What happened in Las Vegas is really kind of scary.
Nationally, the residential solar market is booming, with a 66% increase from 2014 to 2015. And Nevada was one of the standard bearers until...
Bring back solar! Bring back jobs!
That was the scene as hundreds protested dramatic changes to how rooftop solar customers are charged by the utility there. In December, regulators abruptly raised fees and voted to phase out what's known as net metering, which gives customers credit at retail prices for the power they produce. What's more, those changes apply not only to new customers, but existing ones.
I am not hurting anyone.
That's homeowner Donna Waldron, who went solar to save money after her husband died. Public outrage eventually led Nevada to scale back its decision. But many companies have closed shop or left the state, along with hundreds of jobs. And this shockwave is even touching Brandon Cheshire back in Scottsdale.
I've personally received phone calls from three different solar industry executives trying to liquidate panels and liquidate inverters because they're shut down altogether. Yeah, the Vegas solar market is dead.
Cheshire's nervous because Arizona has also seen rapid growth in residential solar, and like Nevada, utilities are pushing back.
I'm not foolish to think that we're not taking on the most profitable, powerful industry that's really ever survived. We've got a huge infrastructure that we're trying to replace.
The dilemma for solar adopters, though, is that they can't replace the infrastructure yet. They still need it. Solar is, by its very nature, intermittent, and customers draw from the grid when the sun isn't shining. Mark Romito is with Arizona Public Service, the state's largest utility.
We're at the tip of the spear in the United States.
He says the growth of rooftop solar in Arizona is explosive and is out of sync with how people consume energy here.
They get the credit for the solar they overproduce.
Overproduce because during midday, solar is churning out the most energy. But that's not when the utilities and their customers need it. Energy use peaks in the evening when people come home.
They've been allowed to bank the credit for their excess generation, however useful or useless it was.
According to Romito, this amounts to a subsidy, which shifts the cost onto all the other ratepayers. But that's not how solar companies see it, or their customers, who purchased and leased expensive systems, believing net metering would save them money. Harvey Bryan is a professor at Arizona State University and says these solar wars here and across the country have put utilities in a tough spot.
There's so many things that what we call legacy industries tend to fight rather than try to incorporate into, a new business model that will come back and hurt them.
Bryan believes a compromise can be possible. That will be put to the test when Arizona Public Service and other utilities go in front of state regulators like Doug Little later this year, possibly to raise solar rates.
One of the key core values in regulatory policymaking is this concept of gradualism.
Little is chair of the Arizona Public Utilities Commission, and he doesn't want to send Arizona's solar industry into a tailspin like what happened in Nevada.
When you start doing things that make broad, abrupt changes to the economic environment here, it's not good for any of us.
This isn't hypothetical for Arizona either. Last year, the state's other major utility, the Salt River Project, increased what solar customers pay, and installations plummeted. And solar installer Brandon Cheshire says if a Nevada-like decision affects the other utilities here,
then what incentive is there to invest in solar unless it's to quell your bleeding heart, right?
The math for customers might just not make sense anymore. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Tonight at ASU, Dr. James Hansen, former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and current professor at Columbia University's Earth Institute, is presenting his talk titled Climate Change and Energy: How Can Justice Be Achieved for Young People and Nature? KJZZ science and innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier caught up with him. Hi, Andrew.
Good afternoon, Mark.
So, Dr. Hansen, this guy's a pretty big deal in the field of climate change, yes?
Sure is. Dr. Hansen has a long career as a climate scientist, having served as NASA's chief climatologist and elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He has been called the father of climate change awareness by not just researching climate, but also being active and speaking to the public, testifying to Congress, and chairing at international climate negotiations, such as the recent Paris talks.
So what will he be focusing on tonight?
Well, he's stressing the importance of engaging young people in climate science and action. His own research is in climate modeling, which he hopes will help young people with understanding the complexity of climate change, but says more is needed.
So if you really want to understand the climate system, you need to use not just models. Models are a useful tool, but only as the extent to which they can simulate processes that are actually going on now and processes that we know from the paleoclimate record of ancient climates occurred in the past. And it's that combination that allows us to understand a very complicated system.
I'm curious how, in looking at, say, designing solutions for the present, you were not much of a fan of what the climate negotiations in Paris were. So what was missed in the talks that happened in Paris?
Well, one thing that's been missed is really getting scientific analysis and thinking into the whole process of the policies that are needed. When I went to Washington, when I was going to testify to Congress, the higher level people would always warn me beforehand, remember, just talk about the science. Policies are for the politicians. You know, that's a bad idea because their solutions are often based on what is useful to them as politicians rather than the most efficient way or even an effective way to solve the problem.
Tonight you'll be speaking at ASU to a number of students and members of the public. What is it now about shifting this dynamic towards the focus of young people? You yourself are a climate activist and have even been arrested a couple of times. What is it now about shifting the focus to young folks about becoming not just climate activists, but now looking and understanding, absorbing the climate science, but applying it in such a way that helps lawmakers, their professors, their climates on their own campus, and into the greater community?
Yeah, it's, you know, the climate change problem is a decadal and even century time scale issue. You don't suddenly see changes on a day-by-day basis. The climate change so far is enough that the observant person who's been around for several decades should notice that at least summer climate in the United States has shifted enough that you can notice the warm seasons are more extreme than they used to be. But we've only felt about half of the climate change due to the gases that are already in the atmosphere because the ocean and the ice sheets change only slowly on decades and century timescales. So the problem is we're leaving for young people a system that's going to be changing more. And one of the impacts, for example, will be sea level rise. I argue that if we stay on business as usual, continued high fossil fuel emissions, that we will get multi-meter sea level rise this century. That will have enormous economic consequences. It will make most of the coastal cities dysfunctional. So, you know, we really can't leave that future to young people. And young people need to understand what's at stake for them.
That was KJZZ's science and innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier speaking with Dr. James Hansen. He's giving a talk tonight called Climate Change and Energy: How Can Justice Be Achieved for Young People and Nature at ASU? Thanks, Andrew.
My pleasure, Mark.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. We'll have clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-50s, sunny and way above normal again tomorrow. Look for a high temperature of 87. Currently with relative humidity at 9%, clear skies and 79 degrees at 251.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
A recent column in the Arizona Daily Star suggested Arizonans have gotten self-satisfied with our water management, use, and conservation methods. Tim Steller wrote the piece and says, in general, we have done a pretty good job, but
things look really different if you look forward. In other words, we may have done well in the past, but the challenges that are going to be that we're going to be confronting in the future are different from what we've experienced in the past, not only with population growth, but most importantly with climate change.
Steller says the temptation for Arizona will be to either keep doing what the state's been doing or even backslide a bit on measures it already has. His column cites a recent report looking at the effect of climate change in the western U.S. Thomas Meixner, a professor in hydrology and atmospheric sciences at the University of Arizona, co-authored that study, and he joins me. So, Thomas, do you agree with the idea that Arizonans have become complacent when it comes to water?
I'm not sure that Arizonans are. I am concerned that particularly in the rural parts of the state, that the political leadership is not taking seriously the real challenges that rural parts of Arizona have with groundwater overdraft.
In terms of making sure that there's enough going forward and not drawing too much for new projects?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a, you know, within the active management areas in Arizona, there's really some of the most robust management of groundwater systems. It maybe could be better, but it's pretty good. Outside of the active management areas, you know, I think Robert Glenn was quoted in the article as basically saying, you know, there basically aren't any rules regarding groundwater extraction, at least at the statewide level. So
it sounds like you're not necessarily concerned about water supplies inside the active management areas. It's outside, well, in the more rural areas that you have concerns.
Yeah, I mean, inside the AMAs, there are concerns, like things like the potential for a call on the river, what that would mean for renewable water supplies for Tucson, Phoenix, Pinal County. But my own experience with certainly water utility managers and people at both the Central Arizona and Salt River projects is they're aware of the sorts of challenges, and they're aware of the challenges, and they also understand they have to be solved somehow. And I think people are working on a variety of approaches to deal with that, you know. And I would note that calls for conservation have been relatively successful. People are using, in the municipalities, are using a lot less water. Certainly farmers in the Yuma region are using less water.
Do you think that the methods that we use, even in the active management areas in Arizona, to manage water, to conserve water, are they good enough for what we're going to need going forward?
I think you never know the future, but we prepare for it anyway. And our best information is that the future looks hotter and drier than it has in the past. Also less snow, which probably means sort of less sort of free storage of water from nature from winter into summer. So, you know, I think what climate change in particular is going to do is make us sort of redouble our efforts. We've been on a track towards more efficiency, more conservation, more desert landscaping and the like. We probably have to continue that push and keep moving forward on it. It's a process that we'll never be done with. We live in a desert. We're going to be continually understanding what our interactions with the available water resources are, how to maintain them, how to enrich them, and how to preserve environmental resources like the Verde River, the San Pedro River, or the Gila that we'd like to maintain.
Thomas Meixner is a professor in hydrology and atmospheric sciences at the University of Arizona.
The Sonoran Desert's wildflower season is often blooming, and it's early. We're several weeks ahead. So to find out what's going on and what kind of beauty to expect, I'm joined by Kim Stone of Boyce Thompson Arboretum. Kim, earlier today, you had a chance to take stock of the wildflowers.
I did. I have been doing it around the Arboretum, but I stopped on my way in to take a look at the Peralta Trail, which is a real popular trail in the Superstitions. In fact, there were 50 cars there when I was in there around 8:30. So it's, yes.
What did you see? What can you describe for us?
I didn't see as much as I was hoping to see. And it's a combination. We're early, but unfortunately, we've had about 2 weeks of 80-degree temperatures. And we had some fairly decent rains, but just like any rains, they're pretty spotty. They're going to be more here and there. It depends on exactly where you are. In this particular spot, I didn't see as much as I was hoping to see. For instance, I didn't see any poppies at all. And I've seen hillsides of poppies there in past years. We're at the Arboretum. In fact, a lot of people don't realize the Arizona Trail crosses the Arboretum there about a half mile down the road. There's quite a few wildflowers this year already. It's early. For where we did get the rains, the flowers are early.
So what's the typical wildflower season?
Typical wildflower season I always use is, you know, we're talking around this elevation, somewhere between, say, 1,500 and 2,500 feet. Usually between mid-March and mid-April for the annuals. And those are the ones that need the rain to germinate. But part of the wildflower season a lot of people don't really think about are the perennials that don't need the water for seed to germinate. They're already there from last year and previous years. That would include the trees and the shrubs and everything else. And those are in a year like this, those are going to be pretty promising. Things like fairy duster, little pink shrubs you've probably seen along the hillsides and along the roads. So usually, even in fair rainfall years, the perennial wildflowers, and that would include the cactus and the palaverdes and the mesquites and all those things, usually those are excellent every year.
So we know how attractive these flowers are. Do they have a greater or different impact on the rest of our environment here in Arizona?
In terms of pollinators, I think that might be the biggest impact that these flowers do, because that's really why they exist.
Yeah.
You know, you're having insects and other critters that pollinate them and create seed, and the seed is what is requisite for the seeds to come up in the following years. And then more of the perennial plants, like the some of the fairy dusters I was talking about in the brittle bushes, and the flat-top buckwheats and those sorts of things, those are a pretty substantial, and as far as mesquites and paloverdes and all those flowers, are substantial nectar sources. In fact, we just started at the Arboretum, we just started a pollinator garden, which features a lot of plants that are known to attract butterflies and bees and other insects. And these are the things that are required to provide the nectar sources for them. And in turn, a lot of insects, insects don't really realize what they're doing, but it's a mutually beneficial relationship. And we just started a whole new garden to feature that.
So, Kim, whenever the current season ends, even if it extends to April, is that it for wildflowers for 2016?
There's a second half of the wildflower season that kicks in when it gets hot, and that's what most people miss, mainly because they're either leaving or because it's too hot for them to get outside. But the second half of the season is when all the trees and the shrubs are blooming. It's when the saguaros are blooming. It's when the ironwoods are blooming, and the paloverdes and the mesquites. And it's all those things that happen. And the Mariposa lilies can be kind of at the early part of that, too. There's a lot of things to see when it starts to get hot. So even if you miss the annual wildflower shows, or if you don't find that they're meeting your expectations, there's always that second half of spring that goes all the way into June here in the Sonoran Desert.
Kim Stone of Boyce Thompson Arboretum in Superior. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.